newsservice.org.
This is Steve Gallington of the People's News, which can be heard on Sundays at noon, Mondays at 9 a.m., and Thursdays at 9 a.m. on 90.1 KPFT HD2, Houston's community radio.
You miss your woman, and I miss my man too.
Hey everybody, this is Glenna Bell, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Is Hank Rubichek, producer of award-winning Soap, What's Your Story? The only show in Houston devoted to storytelling. And we place a spotlight on ordinary people with extraordinary stories to tell. And you're going to find it only here on KPFT HD1, Houston's community station, 90.1 FM on the dial, or on www.kpft.org. You know, David Klontsch is president of the Texas Storytelling Association, one of the places I refer to during announcements. And I'm on the board, and I can tell you with great confidence and conviction that David is the consummate leader. And I'm going to get him to talk a little bit more about TSA in just a few minutes. But right now, I want to tell you what you're in for tonight. It's his collection of stories slated for tonight that will reveal his persona as a special kind of storyteller. You see, David was transformed by storytelling, and it's no hyperbole when I say transformed. As a consequence of this self-discovery, he uses storytelling to connect with people searching for those common denominators which encourage trust and support. In fact, he does it for a living. Here's a teaser. He spent the first 20 years of his career as a project engineer, and then, as he puts it, my right brain woke up and demanded equal time. So for the next decade, David worked as a clown, storyteller, and balloon artist. I guess you could say he was artistically ambidextrous. Now, those colorful performance roles share time with David's job teaching math and science at Archway Academy, a recovery high school here in Houston. It's recognized as a recovery high school because all of Archway students are in recovery from a substance abuse disorder. David, hello. I'm glad you're here. I don't even know what time it is, but I know our show will be on tomorrow. So thank you. It's past our bedtime. It's like 7 o'clock in the evening. People like us are old. I'm so glad you're here. Today's stories really smack of a story program and reveal so much about you and why I argue that storytelling, at least partly, transformed you. Your first story includes a dose of history about AA and chronicles your entry into this world that blends teaching and healing. Tell us the story.
Thank you, Hank, so much for that nice warm welcome. And it is an honor and a privilege to be here. You mentioned that I work at Archway Academy, and that is a recovery high school, which means all of our students are in recovery. And the foundation of most all recovery these days is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's where my stories come from today. My first story starts on January the 23rd, 1961. Bill Wilson, co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, wrote a letter to Dr. Carl Jung. He started that letter by saying, "Dr. Jung, this is a long overdue thank you note. I want to update you on a former patient." Bill goes on to tell the story. Roland Hazard was a fella who was a very successful businessman and politician. He had been a state senator from Rhode Island, but he also couldn't stop drinking. Well, that's not entirely true. He would drink for a while and he would stop for a day or two or three or four. He just couldn't stay stopped, as is so common with that disease of alcoholism. Now, Roland, being a man of means, wanted the best treatment possible. So of the two leading psychiatrists at the time, Dr. Freud and Dr. Jung, Roland decided to go see Dr. Jung. And by that, I mean, he traveled to Switzerland and was under Dr. Jung's treatment for the better part of a year. And in that year, he thought that he had a really, really good handle on this disease and on this problem, and that he had it licked. And he went back with all the confidence that he would be able to stay sober. And it didn't take long for him to relapse yet again. He went back to Dr. Jung. He said, "What is it? What is it about me? Why can't I stop drinking?" And Dr. Jung said, "Frankly, you're one of those hopeless cases, I believe. We have tried everything medically. We have tried everything psychologically. There is nothing more that can be done." Roland was distraught. "Are you saying there's no hope for me at all?" Dr. Jung said, "Well, I don't know, but I've heard of a very few isolated cases where a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening or some sort of religious experience has made men like you turn the other way." Well, Roland thought maybe that could help. So he went back home and he started looking, and he found a group called the Oxford Group. Now, the Oxford Group ministered to anybody that needed help, but part of their ministry did focus on alcoholics. And they insisted on four main traits: a self-survey, an inventory, if you will, a confession — you were supposed to confess your transgressions to another human being — restitution, you were supposed to go out and make your wrongs right, to fix those things that you would cause problems with; service work, carrying the message, if you will, and prayer. Well, Roland started on that path, and he was having some success. He was staying sober for days and weeks and even months. And on his journey, he ran across a fellow named Ebby. Now, Ebby was in court getting ready to go to an asylum. And Roland Hazard, on behalf of the Oxford Group, asked the judge, "Can I be responsible and take him under my wing and minister to him?" And the judge, who knew of Roland's background in the Oxford Group, said, "Yes, we'll give him one more chance." Well, Ebby got sober through this program for the Oxford Group. Now, here's where Bill Wilson comes in, because Ebby and Bill Wilson were long drinking buddies and longtime friends. And Ebby showed up at Bill's doorstep one day to carry the message to his friend. And when Bill opened the door, he could barely even recognize Ebby. "Ebby, is that you?" Ebby said, "Yeah." Bill says, "What in the world? You're so different." Ebby said, "Well, I've quit drinking." "You've what? You've quit drinking? How did you do it?" Well, Ebby says, "I found religion. I found these folks called the Oxford Group, where we have four basic tenets. We do an inventory. We confess our transgressions. We go out and make things right with other people that we have hurt. And we carry the message and we pray." That's when Bill threw his hands up. "Oh, no, it's God. It's religion. I can't do that because there is no God." Bill was a devout atheist. And Bill continued to drink. Well, Bill was treated by a fellow named Dr. Silkworth, Silky, as they called him, that little doctor that loved drunks. And Bill found himself back in the hospital getting what they called the belladonna and barbiturate treatment. Belladonna would calm your stomach. Barbiturates would calm your nerves until you could detox. And Bill was back in the hospital for another belladonna and barbiturate treatment with Silky. And Ebby heard he was in the hospital, so Ebby came back to see his friend again. And Bill said, tell me again, what did you do?" And he said, "You take a self-inventory, and then you confess what you've done wrong, and then you make restitution, and then you carry the message and you pray." And Bill said, "That's it. I, there's no hope for me because there is no God." Ebby left. That night, in the depths of his depression, Bill Wilson cried out, "If there be a God, let him show himself now." And instantly, Bill's room was filled with light. He describes the feeling of being on a mountaintop, leaning into a wind, but it wasn't a wind of air. It was a wind of spirit. He could feel it blowing through his hair. And as quickly as it came, it left. And he was in the bed the next morning when Dr. Silkworth came in. And he said, "Dr. Silkworth, I think I'm over the edge now. It's gone to hallucinations now." And Bill told him what had happened. And Dr. Silkworth said, "I've never heard of anything like that before in my life. But I can tell you one thing, my friend, you better hold on to whatever you have right now, because it's a far cry different than what you came in here with." And Bill Wilson has not had a drink since that day. He died sober. And since he's the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, I always assumed that AA started when he took his last drink. But that's not the way it all started, at least AA. There's way more to that story.
Yeah, I have a feeling there's way more to all of these stories, David. You know, years ago, I did a class at the Jungian Institute here in Houston. And it was a great experience. And I remember when I was asked, how does this class, it was a storytelling class, fit into Jungian psychology? I was saying that providing mutual support for each other is one of the most important things we can do. And you already know that. The AA groups, the Al-Anons are so much committed to making sure that we provide mutual support for each other. And, you know, when I go to some of these meetings, and sometimes I do, the stories that you hear are incredibly poignant and I think demonstrate more bravery from the storyteller in these sessions than you'll ever find. And I know that we're going to talk a little bit more about that a little bit later, but I wanted listeners to know that these groups to which you speak has everything to do with incredible, courageous storytelling. And I want everybody to know that. Your next story actually is called Founder's Day. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about why it's entitled Founder's Day, and then go ahead and tell us that story.
Okay. The day that AA celebrates as its founding is Founder's Day, June the 10th, 1935. And how that came about is what my next story is all about. So I'm just going to go ahead and start, Hank.
Great.
So Bill, being a brand new member of the Oxford group, he took that carrying the message part to heart. He really wanted to work with these other alcoholics. And at these Oxford group meetings, there would be all kinds of people would come in. There were prostitutes, homeless people, anybody that needed ministering would come in. But Bill, he would sit there and he'd watch that door. And as soon as a drunk walked in, he would pretty near knock folks over to get to him. And he would sit the man down and say, "Hey, I've figured this thing out, man. What you need to do is you need to take an inventory. You need to tell somebody about all of your transgressions. You need to go out and make restitution for all the things that you've done wrong. You need to do service. You need to go out and carry the message. And you need to pray." And he would preach that over and over and over and over. And he stayed sober through this whole process, but he wasn't getting anybody else sober. And he was extremely discouraged. Well, he was a stock man. That was his trade, stocks on Wall Street. And he was unemployable before he started going to the Oxford group. So as he started getting sober, life started getting back together a little bit, and he was starting to get some calls from some of his old clients, and he needed some income. So he very carefully put together a very meticulous business plan. He had it all figured out. He needed to go to a stockholder meeting in Akron, Ohio, and all he needed was a vote yes on his plan, and that was going to set him back on to where he needed to be financially. And he was getting ready for this trip, and he was still working with folks at the Oxford group. And he sat down with Dr. Silkworth, Silky, that little doctor that loved drunks. And he said, "Dr. Silkworth," said, I'm such a failure." Silky said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "Well, I haven't gotten anybody sober." And Dr. Silkworth says, "Well, hold on. You haven't had a drink in more than 6 months, have you?" Bill said, "Well, yeah, there is that, but I haven't been able to carry the message. I haven't been able to get anybody else to do this." And Dr. Silkworth said, maybe you're going at it just a little bit wrong. You've been telling folks what they're supposed to do. Why don't you just share your experience? Tell them what you did and what happened to you. Bill thought, okay, that's kind of a new twist. So Bill traveled to Akron, got all of his stuff together. He checked into the Mayflower Hotel. He had all of he was so excited because this was the deal that was going to put him back on the map. And as he went to this stock meeting, the shareholder meeting, this whole business plan just crumbled right before his very eyes. All of his hard work just evaporated. He was distraught. He went back to the hotel. He was walking across the lobby because he was going into the lounge. He was going into the bar to take a drink. He could hear the laughter coming out of the lounge. He could hear the ice clinking in the glass. But as he's walking across the lobby, he notices a list of churches. Ah, hold on. Maybe if I could find another drunk here, I could work with. So he started calling that list of churches. He found a representative from an Oxford group. He said, hey, my name is Bill Wilson. I'm from New York. I'm a drunk, and the only way I can stay sober is working with another drunk. Is there anybody that you know that I might be able to work with? And that person says, well, I don't know anybody, but I do know somebody who's a member of the local Oxford group, and maybe she could help. So gives Bill Wilson Henrietta Cyberling's phone number. Well, Bill calls Henrietta Cyberling, said, Ms. Cyberling, my name is Bill Wilson. I am a drunk from New York City, and the only way I can stay sober is working with other drunks. Is there anybody that you know that I might be able to talk to? Well, Henrietta's face lit up. Because Henrietta, as a member of the Oxford group, had a good friend named Annie Smith. And Henrietta and Annie had been praying daily that someone would come into Dr. Bob Smith's life. Dr. Bob was a very avid alcoholic. They prayed every day, would someone please come into his life that could talk to him about this disease? And when Bill Wilson said that, she said, I know exactly who you need to talk to. Well, now this phone call took place on Saturday, the day before Mother's Day, 1935. And Dr. Bob had been out drinking that day, and there was no way he would be in any shape to talk to anybody. So they made arrangements on Mother's Day to meet at the guardhouse. The Cyberlings were very wealthy people, and they made arrangements to meet at the guardhouse. And Annie Smith had talked Bob into going. He said, I'll give him 15 minutes, no more. So they'd agreed 15-minute meeting in the library at the guardhouse. And 2.5 hours later, Dr. Bob came out and said, that man knows what he's talking about. Well, Dr. Bob tried to stay sober. He had a big meeting coming up with the American Medical Association. He went to that meeting. No one wanted him to go. He was a little bit headstrong. He went anyway. He got drunk again on that trip. But when he came home, he decided he was going to do this thing. And so on June the 10th, he took his last drink. And when the second man got sober, that is Founders Day. It wasn't when Bill, but when he successfully carried the message to the second man. So Dr. Bob and Bill are now trying to find drunks to work with. And after a few weeks, Dr. Bob called the hospital and said, hey, I'm Dr. Bob Smith. I want to work with some alcoholics, called the ward where they house the alcoholics. And the nurse there said, yeah, who is this? A Dr. Smith? He said, well, we've got a plan that we can work with alcoholics. And the nurse says, well, Dr. Smith, have you tried it on yourself? He said, yes. And I've been sober for a couple of weeks, and it really works. Is there anybody else that you know of we can talk to? And the nurse said, yep, we've got a candidate right down the hall. He just punched a nurse's lights out. We've got him tied to the bed. Please come. So Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson went into AA number 3's room. He was also a Bill, and sat with him for over an hour and talked. And that man, AA number 3, there's a famous picture of the man in the bed where Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob are ministering to this man in the bed. And that man walked out of the hospital on July the 4th, 1935, a free man, never to drink again.
That's incredible. That's incredible. You know, let me ask you this, first of all. You know, every story has a bunch of lessons, a bunch of parables, and there's a lot here. What is the single most important takeaway you want listeners to get from this story?
I think the biggest part about this whole thing is the giving of yourself and giving of your time and carrying the message and telling, but also not telling them what they need to do, just sharing your experience, strength, and hope. Right. And if they hear part of their story and yours, that's when the magic happens.
Right. And I asked David because, you know, I mean, there's no clowning around tonight with these stories, right? No pun intended. I know that's what you did for a living. But, you know, a lot of times listeners, and they'll write to me and they'll text me and they'll ask this. They'll say, you know, those were great stories. Why is it that that storyteller, given his or her tremendous repertoire, chose those for tonight? So what's going on in the world right now that would compel you to tell this set of stories? I know that's a kind of a very comprehensive question, but what would you say to that?
One of the biggest reasons I love to tell these stories is I love history and being a storyteller. I love the stories that come out of history. Mm-hmm. And being a teacher at Archway Academy, as I said, you know, the 12 steps is the foundation to this whole program that we work at Archway. And so it's very, very close to the heart of most of my students.
Yeah. You know, Rudyard Kipling said it best. If history were taught in story form, nothing would ever be forgotten. Mm-hmm. So, I get it. Richard Stone, you know, in his Healing Heart of Art of Storytelling, one of my favorite books, that really addresses exactly the kind of contexts that you're talking about tonight, describes this concept called destorification, which is the growing absence of the need for story in our society. And I think this is why your slate of stories is so very important. You do the contrary. You talk about storytelling as being not only essential, but downright urgent. And there's a lot of research that's really reinforcing that claim. There isn't a lot of space that we make in our world for stories. And this context, AA, makes it very clear that stories aren't just relevant. They're absolutely imperative. And I think it's so important for us to know that. You know, Houston is a great place to make plenty of space, now that the segue is there, for anybody interested in storytelling. Just want to make a few announcements. Our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, is a great place to learn about storytelling. We meet virtually the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Just go ahead to www.houstonstorytellers.org, and the Zoom link will be under events. Our members are terrific, and we are great coaches, kind, supportive, and instructive. And for those of you who want to take advantage of that, we're there to give it. And as I mentioned earlier, you can also take your skills to the next level by joining the Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network. Also, our friends at the Moth meet up at the Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month. Better get tickets online because they go fast, and get there because you're going to have the time of your life. If you have any ideas for guests or ideas for shows, please drop us a line on our Facebook page or send me an email to SWYS, the acronym for So What's Your Story, of course, at kpft.org, or text me, Hank, at 832-277-1581. That is Hank at 832-277-1581. Label it Show Idea or SWYS, and I'm one of the few people who will actually get back to you. This is your host, Hank Rubicek, with my guest teller, David Klonch, and you are listening to So What's Your Story on Houston's community station, KPFT HD1, 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. David, before you get to your next story, take a minute, if you would, and tell us a little bit about the power of TSA. How can people join?
I'm glad you asked, because that's one of my favorite things in the whole wide world to talk about. We are Tejas Storytelling Association. We chose the name Tejas when we started because we wanted to be a little bit bigger than Texas. I know not many things out there are bigger than Texas, but we wanted to include Louisiana and part of Oklahoma, because that was the original Tejas.
Yeah, and plus we're very sensitive to other international countries. So, you know, yeah.
And we, as Hank has said, we nurture storytellers. We have many, many opportunities. We've got guilds all over the state. And our showcase event is the City of Denton Texas Storytelling Festival. Happens in Denton, Texas. It's going to be 2023, next year, March the 9th through the 12th. If you want any information at all, our website is Tejas Storytelling. That's T-E-J-A-S, TejasStorytelling.com. Or get a hold of Hank.
Yep, and I will get all of that on our Facebook page. I think I'm going to get some hate mail making reference to Louisiana and Oklahoma as international audiences. Yeah, I think they picked up on it. I love you guys. We're just having some fun. Okay, yeah. Okay. All right, now, a footnote traditionally embedded into AA stories is up next. Tell us that one.
Yes, it is. And, you know, one of the things that I love are the twists and turns and these things that we might call coincidences. I've heard it said, is it odd or is it God? And this next story that shows up, as you said, in footnotes most places, I think is one of those stories. So Bill and Bob, Bill in New York City, Bob in Akron, they start doing this thing. They start carrying the message. They start talking to people. They start sharing their story, and they start getting other folks to participate. And eventually, they hit a milestone. They had 100 drunks that had been successfully sober. And they thought, well, we should have a meeting. They all got together with this milestone of 100. They figure they really are on to something. So at this meeting in Akron, Ohio, Bill, being the stock man, being the salesman, the consummate salesman, he decides we've got to make this thing big. We need clinics all over the country. We need ambassadors to go out. We need literature. We need all of this stuff. And Bob, being the very simple kind of country doctor, says, no, we don't need to get big. What we've got right now works. We don't need to get big. So in the negotiation there, they did agree to write a book. So in 1939, the Big Book was published. Bill and a lot of the folks in New York wrote it. He would pace back and forth smoking cigarettes, and a woman named Ruth Hawk would peck it out on the old typewriter. They didn't have those fancy dancy word processors. And then they'd bring those back to their the different meetings, and people would read them and edit them. And that's how the Big Book was written. Well, after it got written, now we need to get it out there and get some publication. Well, as it was being written, one of Bill's friends worked at Reader's Digest, and Bill had mentioned to him, you know, we think we're doing something here, and we think we got something going on, and we're writing a book. And Reader's Digest said, sure, we'd love to publish a book or be part of a book like that and publicate or advertise it. And so they wrote the book, and as soon as the book was written, Bill went back to his friend at Reader's Digest and said, we're ready, and the book's done. And the fellow says, oh, I guess I should have told you. I carried that up to my bosses, and they said, we're not interested at all. Well, Bill, being the salesman, he's again crushed. How are we going to do this? Well, without Bill even knowing, somebody had written a little bitty article about Alcoholics Anonymous in a magazine called The Liberty, and that had made a little bit of ripples in the world, and the folks at Saturday Evening Post heard of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous and that they have a way that they're fixing alcoholics. And they thought it was nothing but a scam. Well, there was an investigative reporter named Jack Alexander who had just finished a great big expose on racketeering in New Jersey. And the New York Post, the Saturday Evening Post, hired Jack Alexander to go sniff out this scam. Go find out how this thing has happened. We want to know the dirt. And so Jack Alexander goes and meets Bill Wilson and starts hearing some of the stories, and he's hearing the he's seeing the after stories, these successfully well-adjusted people, businessmen, lawyers, all of these people, and hearing what they used to be like. And he's kind of skeptical, and he's not really buying it, but he hears the story over and over in New York, and they make a trip to Akron, and he's hearing those stories over and over, and he sees the end result. He sees the after, and he hears stories about the before, and he's, okay, maybe there's something to this. I don't know. They go to Cleveland, and again, he's hearing these stories. He's seeing the after. He's hearing stories of the before. And he goes to Chicago, and finally he goes to St. Louis. And he's sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in St. Louis, and he's seeing the afters, and he's hearing this one particular voice, and he's listening to this man, and he's looking at him, and he kind of recognizes him. And then he asks, are you Brian? Are you, hold it, you're Brian. Well, see, Jack grew up in St. Louis, and he knew the town drunk to be Brian. He knew the before, and now he's meeting the after. That is when he got it. He wrote a fabulous article in the Saturday Evening Post. It was published March the 1st, 1941, March the 1st. Wonderful article, put us on the map. At the beginning of that year, we had less than 2,000 members. At the end of that year, AA had over 8,000 members. It grew astonishingly. And that's what put us on the map. It's grown ever since then. And that brings us back to the letter. Bill, writing to Carl Jung. Dear Dr. Jung, this is a long overdue thank you note. And he goes on to say, no doubt you've probably heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, but you might not know how you contributed to this whole thing. And told him the story as he understood it about Roland, and Roland carrying the message to Ebby, and Ebby carrying it to Bill, and Bill carrying the message to Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob to AA number 3, and then the first 100, and then the book. And just shared with Dr. Jung his contribution to this whole thing. Well, that letter was written on January the 23rd, 1961. Dr. Jung wrote a letter back 1 week later, January the 30th, 1961. And that letter, basically, I'll paraphrase, starts off saying, oh my gosh, thank you so much. I always wondered what happened to that guy, Roland. I am so grateful that you told me, because yes, I've heard of AA. And yes, I know the work that the program has done. And in that is a quote that we often hear. It's a Latin quote, spiritus contra spiritum. Basically, Dr. Jung's thought was that spirits, we call alcohol spirits kind of touch that same part of the soul that we want touched by spirit. And spiritus contra spiritum, a spiritual experience will fix a disease of alcoholism and spirits. And that's where this whole notion that a religious or a spiritual experience is the key to fixing this whole thing. And that just shows up as a little footnote, this little letter from Dr. Bob to Carl Jung, and then Carl Jung's letter back. But to me, that just brings this whole thing full circle.
Yeah, you know, that's a great story, David. That's a great story. It reminds me, and I forget whose quote it is, but it goes, life doesn't get easier or more forgiving. We simply get stronger and more resilient. Does that make sense? I don't know if you've ever heard that, but that's what I'm thinking about. Recovery is hard, but regret is even harder. Mm-hmm. What a great story. Great story. Your last story is called Prayer Bubbles.
Yes.
I love this story. I love this title, but I know a little bit about the story, and I love that too. Tell us this story.
This story has many, many different starts. I think I'm just going to jump into this notion as my right brain started to demand equal time. I walked away from an engineering career, and I went to East Tennessee State University, and I enrolled as a storytelling student to get a master's degree in storytelling. And I was extremely fortunate because that I enrolled in August of 2007. In December of 2007, the storytelling program, was going to a country called Bhutan. Bhutan is a teeny tiny country. It's actually smaller than West Virginia. Its southern border is India. Its northern border is what used to be the Tibetan portion, part of the Tibetan portion of China. To get there, you fly by several of the highest peaks in the world, including Mount Everest. It is an amazing little country. It's a kingdom, and they, because of their nature, they don't really care so much about GNP, gross national product, as they do about GNH, gross national happiness. And part of their tenets of gross national happiness is cultural preservation. And as a result of that, Bhutan had decided to host a storytelling conference, and that's where we were going. We were going to Bhutan for the storytelling conference in December of 2007. I was very excited. But a couple of weeks before we were leaving, Joseph, our director there at ETSU, Dr. Joseph Sobel, got a call from the folks that he was connecting with in Bhutan. And they said, you know what? We're sorry as we can be, but our astronomers had looked at the stars, and that's just not a good time to have a storytelling conference. We're going to cancel the whole thing. What? We've got everything planned. We've got everything bought. We've got visas. We're coming anyway. And they said, well, okay, that's fine. We'll just have all of the people that we've hired to do lectures come to your hotel and do the lectures for the 15 storytellers from ETSU. Oh, that was cool. We had, we heard from the head of the monastic brand, the head monk. We spent about 2.5 hours with a lama that taught us a lot about their tradition of Buddhism. We got to meet the head of the national magazine or the national newspaper. It was wonderful 3 days. And after those 3 days were over, we got to travel and sightsee. Their temples and forts are the same structures, and they call them zongs. And so we got to visit different zongs. Now, one thing about Bhutan, it's way up in the mountains. It's a beautiful, the lowest parts are about 7,000 feet, and everything goes up from there. So we had to acclimate to the altitude, which was a challenge. And they have prayer flags, everything. If it's stationary, they span from one stationary structure to another with prayer flags, beautiful red, yellow, blue, green prayer flags. And their belief is that as the wind blows, the vibrations cause the prayers that are on those prayer flags to go out to universe. So we're traveling all over this country and learning about their traditions and their religion, visiting these zongs. Well, one of the zong we were going to was called the Tangu Monastery. Now, we got in a van, we rode on these little windy trails that you're almost on the edge of seasickness getting there, and we parked about 8,000 foot elevation, and then we had to hike up about another 1,000 feet. So we were winded. It was a very difficult hike, but periodically you'd stop. I would stop and catch my breath and take a drink of water. And I'd turn and I look at this amazing, beautiful valley with prayer flags spanning everything that was stationary and a beautiful crystal blue sky. There were, I think we saw 3 clouds the whole time we were there. There was just nothing between us and the atmosphere. It was gorgeous. We got up to where the Tangu Monastery was after this beautiful journey. And we're standing there kind of catching our breath. And you did mention earlier that I was a clown. Part of the tradition of being a Clowns of America International clown is if you're traveling to a country, a foreign country, you can be designated as the international ambassador from the Clowns of America International. We call ourselves a COAI to the country. So I had a little nameplate. I was the international ambassador from the Clowns of America International to Bhutan. They thought I was a celebrity. I didn't argue with them. Well, one of the other things you're supposed to do if you're the Clowns of America International ambassador is the internet, our group has a magazine called The New Calliope. And you're supposed to take your new calliope and get your picture made in front of different landmarks in that country. So I had my magazine out, and I was having my picture made in front of the Tangu Monastery. And there were two monks that were watching me, and they were kind of interested in my magazine. Well, they chew a thing called a betel nut up there, which is red, and it kind of causes your teeth to rot a little bit, but it stimulates kind of like a coffee. And one of those guys didn't have many teeth, but he had red lips. And when he grinned, it was a toothless grin. And the other guy, I'd never understood why, but he would bury his face in his elbow and cover his face with his burgundy robe. And his body would shake when he laughed. He didn't want us to see him laughing. I didn't understand why. But I'm standing in front of the Tangu Monastery with my Clowns of America and my new calliope. And they start looking at it. So I start showing them the pictures. And one of the pictures is of our military in camouflage utilities with red clown noses on. They thought that was the funniest thing they'd ever seen. The fellow's got his face buried in his elbow, body just rocking, and the other fellow with his toothless grin. And then I remembered, in my backpack, I've got one of those foam red clown noses. So I go get it out of my backpack. I put it on me. They think it's the funniest thing they've ever seen. And then I have a thought. I wonder what kind of international incident might happen if the international ambassador from COAI put a clown nose on a monk. So I walk over and gently put it on the one that had the toothless grin. And his eyes got real big. He didn't really know what to do, but his buddy buried his face in his elbow, and his body was just rocking. And slowly, that fella grinned a great big toothless grin. I realized he didn't know what to do with that, so I gently pulled it off of his nose and handed it to him as a gift. And we said our goodbyes because I could see the crowd was getting ready to move into the temple. We walked through a little archway into a big courtyard. And as we were walking away, my friend ML nudged me and pointed back. And those guys were taking turns with the clown nose and just having the best time. Well, from there, we went into the temple. All of the wood is all freshly painted, and it's, again, just bright orange and yellow and red and green and blues. It's all just beautiful. And they taught us how to be respectful to their sacred spaces. So we were just walking through, and all of a sudden we noticed there was some commotion right next to the altar. And we noticed they were pulling back a gate, and they invited us back into the inner sanctum behind the altar. And we got back there, and there was three great big Buddhas. The Buddha of the present was in the middle, and on either side was the Buddha of the future and the Buddha of the past. And we were offered a little carpet square to sit cross-legged and meditate. And as we were meditating, I remembered what the Lama had said. They focus on reduction of suffering and compassion. And as I sat there and took a couple of breaths meditating, it occurred to me the one thing that has caused my family the most suffering is the disease of alcoholism or addiction. And I'm pondering that, and I'm thinking about compassion and how compassionate the folks are with this program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Bill Wilson and that whole journey. And I've got tears running down my cheeks because it had only been about 8 months since my younger brother had died of the disease of alcoholism. And I'm sitting there just in those moments, breathing. And then it's time to go. And they gently take us out of our meditation, and we give them back their carpet square, and we walk back out into the temple. And I looked around, and a lot of cheeks were wet. I don't know where those other folks had gone on their meditation, but it had obviously been a very moving event for everybody. And we came back out front, came back into that little courtyard, and we walked through. And now out in front of the zong, where there were two monks, now there's about a dozen and a half. And we were quite the spectacle. And I realized, oh my gracious, in that same bag where my clown nose was, I've got bubbles. So I reach in and I pull out a jar of bubbles, and I open them up, and I'm blowing bubbles, and they're floating out into this amazing cloudless sky. And I don't know if those fellas had never seen bubbles before. I can tell you they reacted like kindergartners. They were giggling and laughing and popping bubbles, and I let them blow a few bubbles, and then I gave them the bubble with the wand, and they started blowing their own bubbles. And then it was time to go on back down to the van. And as we were walking down that mountain, and I was thinking about all of the stuff that we'd seen and all of the stuff we've been able to do, one of my friends said, David, those were prayer bubbles, because they're born of the breath and they're sent out into universe with our prayers. And I thought, oh, so beautiful. Absolutely. Those are prayer bubbles. So that's my story I call prayer bubbles.
Oh, that's a beautiful story. That is a beautiful story. So they never saw bubbles, huh, with one of those wands?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That is such a beautiful story. What do you want us to take from that? There's a lot of stuff there too.
One of the things that I transformed from that, I was very, very apprehensive about the whole trip. I was apprehensive about this whole notion of quitting being an engineer and going to storytelling. What? I was apprehensive about some of my story, too. I'm clown, as you know. I clown in the hospitals. And those first couple of times I would take that risk, and that I was petrified, Hank. I was scared to death. And yet pushing through those moments of seeing those guys' faces light up when they see bubbles, or looking at their grin when I show them the pictures of our men in uniform, camouflage utilities, our combat men with the red noses, or just those moments. Those moments are, I've heard it said that life begins outside of our, just at the edge of our comfort zone. And what I hope people hear is, man, life is amazing. Get out there and live it. And if it scares you, go even faster, go stronger towards it.
Yeah, beautiful. That's a beautiful, beautiful notion. You know, I think that's true. I think that that life really does begin when we just get outside our comfort zone. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's so fundamental. What I love about your stories is that there are clusters of these memorable moments frozen in time. And when you tell them, they really unfold beautifully. It's as if they're thawing, as if they're frozen, and now they're being thawed. You know what I'm saying? That's what I feel like when you tell these stories, and they're really beautiful. You know, this storytelling degree, what prompted you to get a storytelling degree? I know you were interested in the artsy stuff. I know that. But why a storytelling degree? You could have gone
It's a long story, as most of them are, but I had, when I went to high school, in East Tennessee, which is where all of this happens, the storytelling in Jonesboro.
Right.
And through no fault of my own, when I went to Marine Corps boot camp, when I came home, my family had moved to Virginia. And so when I came home, I went to Virginia, and that's where engineering and all of that stuff happened. And I was all of a sudden awakened to this new art of clowning. I found storytelling in the summer of 2003, as well as the art of clowning. And I went to my first storytelling festival there in Jonesboro in October 2003. And as I was walking out of the visitor center, I was looking at a rack of rack cards that nobody ever pays any attention to. And I look up in East Tennessee State University, which when I was a high school student there at Daniel Boone High School, that's where I was going to go to college until the family moved. So I look up in ETSU, and they've got a master's degree in storytelling. And a little bit of payback. My mom always wanted me to get a master's degree. I was an engineer. Go get a master's degree. So when I said, I'm going to get a master's degree, her face lit up. And I said, in storytelling, she was like, what? that's how that came about.
Right, right. The good news is that I'm getting a master's degree. The bad news is that it's a storytelling, right? Exactly. Well, what are some of the classes that you would take in that curriculum?
So the
first, our listeners are interesting, because some of them actually, absolutely, of our listeners are, that we have a great group of listeners. We really do.
A lot of it was very, very, I don't know what it's like now because it's changed a lot. But when I started in 2007, the first couple of classes, you take a basic storytelling class where you learn six stories. You need to learn, you know, in the different genres. Some of them, there was, you know, dialogue in it. Some of them were partner stories. Some of them were folk tales. Some of them were historic stories. So you learn, you know, you learn six basic stories, and it's all performance based. You're absolutely out there telling stories. And so you do a lot of that performance based stuff. But then there's also the historical and the historical aspects of storytelling, historical HMP, historical and psychological aspects of storytelling. We do take a class in linguistics where we learn, you know, how sounds are made and phonemes, and all of that stuff was very, very challenging to me. But we also do some specific stuff, like we did. I did a class on women's studies. And so we came out of that with a program about female body image and some of those things. So it was transformative on many different fronts for me.
And, you know, you use the word transformative, and I love that because I always make it very clear that storytelling can be transformative. We really do become better people. We evolve somehow. And I started to say that our listeners are a great group, and our listeners really are a great group. And I say that because they have questions about, you know, what makes a good storyteller a storyteller? Where can you study storytelling? What kind of degrees are there? It's amazing the kind of questions we get. So I really do appreciate that. Who was the storyteller in your home growing up? Was there one?
Well, you know, I think about my friend Antonio Sacre, who says that, you know, he's out there making a living storytelling, and his dad says, you know, funny thing, you're making a living storytelling. You're maybe the ninth best storyteller in the family. Both of my brothers are far better storytellers and far funnier than I was. The irony is that I, you know, I've done a lot more of it than they are, but they are very, very funny and very good storytellers. And my dad was he's from the mountains of Kentucky. So, you know, and even at that, Hank, and you know as well as I do, we as human beings, we relate by story. That's how we communicate. If someone gives you three pieces of information, three facts, your brain is automatically building story around it as soon as you hear those three facts.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the idea of painting a verbal picture is so magnificently magic. We really do that. We do. Let me ask you one more question in another minute or so. You know, if someone says to you, we get these questions all the time. Someone says to you, you know, I'd love to tell stories, David, but I've got nothing interested in my life to say. What would you say to them?
Any event, you know, they're going to tell a story. And anybody's story is valuable. One of the things that we learned, especially these common genres, when we were in Bhutan, we were studying stories that had the same roots and same motifs as a lot of our Jack tales. You know, a heartbreak is a heartbreak, regardless of what language you speak, or, you know, a broken heart is a broken heart. And a story about that reaches everyone. And your story is valuable. There's only one person on the planet that has your story, and it is worthy being told.
That is a beautifully, beautifully said summary, for lack of another word. It's not so much a summary, but it's a great way to kind of close this off, because your stories were extraordinarily poignant, much more so than we usually get on the show. Because again, as I said earlier, your stories really were a program tonight. It was a chronology of events, and very memorable. And all I can say is that I'm really proud to know someone like you, and I'm really proud to call you a friend. And what a beautiful fusion of urgency and humor in these stories. Thank you, David Klonch, for your raw, authentic style and for letting us through the windows of your soul. You are an excellent example of what Mark Twain always meant when he said, "Show me someone who knows what's funny, and I'll show you someone who knows what isn't." Happy Hanukkah to everybody, and a very Merry Christmas in a few days. You're listening to this on the 21st, so get ready for the wonderful time of your life. And how about telling a story or two, huh? That would be a great gift. And stay where you are. Everybody stay where you are, because after the news comes Living Art, another KPFT exclusive. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and be sure to join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't end happily, it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. peace.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In Tuvalu, Kiribati, the Marshall Islands, and other small Pacific Island nations, the tuna fishing industry is a linchpin of the economy.
It is very significant, mainly in revenue for the countries.
Sangalofa Clark is CEO of the Parties to the Nauru Agreement Office. The organization was created by an agreement among small Pacific Islands to collaboratively manage the region's tuna fishery. Fishing vessel owners from around the world pay access fees to fish in these nations' waters. And in several of the countries, that money provides more than 40% of government revenue each year. But as oceans warm, tuna populations are expected to shift east and north into waters beyond these nations' jurisdiction. Clark was part of a team that estimated the potential losses in fishing fees revenue for 10 small island economies if carbon pollution keeps increasing through 2050.
The changes are projected to cause a loss in government revenue of around $90 million a year.
So although these countries generate only a tiny amount of carbon pollution, they will pay a steep price for the warming caused by others. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
KPFT has a brand new call-in talk show with you in mind.
This is You Talk.
Sometimes fun.
We're going to have some fun because that's what we're supposed to be here for.
Sometimes controversial.
We had a great fascist government here for almost 4 years. It had a chance to prove itself and then unexpectedly lost an election, which is still up for debate.
Always entertaining and relevant.
And that's what we're about, by the way, stirring things up, opening new conversations. That's one of the ones we're having right now.
Give us a call. Let us know what you think. The letter U, then talk with Steve Hunter, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 a.m. here on KPFT.
This is KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM.
KPFT has been a staple in the Houston area and surrounding communities for over 50 years. With an amazing volunteer staff, we are able to produce exclusive programming that you cannot hear anywhere else. From every genre to the local current affairs programs, our volunteers give 100% to the communities in which we serve. As KPFT continues to evolve, we ask for your input and we ask that you support the arts, music, news, international news, and current affairs that you've come to know and love. With your support, we've been able to grow our programming and serve our communities more now than ever before. As time changes, isn't it good to know that you have a community station that does too? If you have not sent in your contribution to KPFT, now is a perfect time to do just that. Go online to kpft.org. Giving could never be easier. Thank you for your support of Houston's community station for over 50 years. 90.1 KPFT and FM HD1, Houston.
It all rolls into one. 1 p.m. Saturday, that is. That's when Deadbeat starts on 90.1 KPFT, a three-hour musical ride each and every week featuring the music of the Grateful Dead and surrounding family. 90.1 is not a strange place on the dial, but you can get shown the light just the same as you make those trips around the sun. So join me on Pacifica's 90.1 KPFT FM, FM HD1 Houston,